So this talk is called The Eight Worldly Winds and the Law of Karma. And I've got a dedication. I'd like to dedicate this talk to everybody who is sleeping rough in the streets tonight. Yeah, anywhere on this island and beyond. So here we are in this comfortable Buddhist centre in Sockyhol Street. And if you want to walk up and down Sockyhol Street, it's inescapable, really, that in the last 9 months to a year, the number of people who are sleeping out in the streets has shot up dramatically, and also the number of people begging in the streets really gone up in a big way. So, I was just thinking about these people, and I was thinking, well, it's great that we are here. We've got the leisure and the opportunity, the leisure and endowment to practice the Dharma together. But those people who I was thinking about today out there, they're just trying to survive. So any benefit that might in any magical way come from what we do here this evening, I would like to dedicate that to those people and their survival. So I'm going to talk about the eight worldly winds, and also say a little bit about the four right efforts that you find in the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, the four right efforts. But when I started to think about this talk, I realised that I wanted to start by talking about the four reflections that turn the mind to the Dharma. Yeah, the four mind-turning reflections. So I'm guessing that most of you are going to have at least some level of familiarity with the four mind-turning reflections. And maybe if you don't, you will have, because they come into the Mitra Study course. There's a really great module on the four mind-turnings. So at some point, hopefully, you will be studying that. Thank you, Bill. Thanks for bringing that in. So they are... Sorry, you people might not be able to see them. You might want to move. The preciousness, this precious human birth, is the first one. And then there's a reflection on impermanence. And then on the law of karma. And then on the faults of conditioned existence. Yeah, which I, for some reason, have taken to calling the defects of samsara. I wrote that up and somebody went, defects? And I went, ah, well. That's what they are tonight. So just going straight into the preciousness of human birth. Yeah. So this is obviously a call for us to wake up to the fact that we have here great, rare opportunity. Yeah? So do not let this opportunity go to waste. Yeah? This is a very strong call to turn away from complacency. Yeah? And to reorient your perspective so that you see with a more creative eye. Yeah, that you become sensitive to the little opportunities that open up a couple of dozen times a day, yeah, more, every moment, yeah, the preciousness of human birth. So there's a really famous simile about this rare opportunity, the precious human birth, and it's the one about the turtle, yeah? So do people know the one about the turtle? Yeah, okay, so, but I'm going to do the one about the turtle anyway. So there is a vast, endless ocean, yeah? Mile upon mile upon mile of ocean. And deep in the ocean, there is a blind turtle swimming. Blind turtle swimming in a vast ocean underneath the water. I'm floating on the top of the ocean, buffeted by the waves. There has been tossed a wooden yoke, you know, the kind of wooden thing that an animal would put its head and shoulders through. A beast of burden would pull something with this yoke. So this yoke, this wooden ring, large wooden ring, is floating on the surface of the ocean. And one time every 100 years, the blind turtle surfaces and his head pops up once every 100 years. And the chance of you attaining this precious human birth is the same odds as it is for that blind turtle to get his head through that wooden yoke. Yeah? That's the chances of us all, each one of us, being here today. Yeah? It's unlikely. And yet here it is. So that's telling us that this is a rare opportunity. Why? Why is it rare and precious? Because of number two. Because of impermanence. Yeah. So we don't have that much time. Yeah. We don't have that much time. Out there outside the shrine room, there's that Wheel of Life painting. And you know that in the God realm, there stands a Buddha. And he's playing a lute. He's playing a song of impermanence to those people in the God realm. That's us. Yeah. When we think about the people sleeping out in the street tonight, that's us. Yeah. So the Buddha is playing the song of impermanence to us. Yeah. This song of a universal truth. Yeah. So we can't know this too much. Can't know it too strongly. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead has got an interesting perspective, because it's not just telling us page after page after page that this life is short and that the sands of time are running out short on this life. It's saying that all states are impermanent, yeah? So the Tibetan Book of the Dead deals with these six bardos, and they're all real short, every one of them, yeah? So there's this. This is what the Tibetan Book of the Dead is calling the bardo of life. Yeah? So a bardo is like an intermediate state between other states. And this is the bardo of life, and it's short. And it tells us about the bardo of dreams. There's opportunities for practice in the bardo of dreams if you recognize them, but it's short. And the bardo of meditation is short. And the bardo of death is short. And there's this in-between state, the dharmata, which is the state in between death and the next becoming. And it's short. And then your rebirth, the bardo of becoming, is fleeting. Yeah, so the Tibetan Book of the Dead is saying, well, it all is passing at an incredible rate, and it's all impermanent. Yeah? So we're impermanent, and all the things upon which we rely are impermanent. And any attributes, any attainments even, that we might move around, they're all impermanent too. Does this sound really gloomy? It's a real question. Does it sound gloomy?
No.
Okay, oh, well, that's nice. Does it make you feel nihilistic?
No.
What's the point? Yes and no. Okay, we've got a bit of both. Well, look, there is some good news, right? There is some good news. I'm not being Pollyanna-ish. It's just that it just so happens that because things are impermanent, it means not only that change is possible, but that change is inevitable. Yeah? And you know that, don't you? Change is the constant. Yeah. Change is inevitable. The law of karma. Number three. So, this is really cool, actually. This is good. This is party time. All willed actions, yeah? All deliberate acts produce effects that roll on. And that is amazing. More of that soon. Number four. The characteristics, the faults of conditioned existence, the defects of samsara, yeah? So, right up there, top of the shop, the Buddha is telling us about dukkha, yeah? He's telling us about that ill-fitting chariot wheel, yeah? And what this last mind-turning is saying is that we cannot, try though we might, try as hard as you can, we cannot make samsara work for us, yeah? It doesn't, yeah? Just to kind of touch into those little glimpses in life is king, flowers wither when touched. ice suddenly cracks beneath our feet. Just doesn't matter what you're trying to achieve, whether you're trying to get a holiday because you're a bit tired and you're a bit run down, you're trying to get a holiday, or you're trying to move house, or you're trying to sort out your relationship with your mother. You can't make it work the way you want it to work. Yeah, it does its own sweet thing. Yeah, because there are just these defects that we kind of get on top of. Yeah, but what we can do is we can work with this law of karma. Yeah, we can work with it. Yeah, so positive acts deliberately done and with as little clinging as we can manage will have positive results in this world. So there's nothing we can do about the defects of samsara, and there's nothing we can do about the fact that positive acts fruit. So we will continue to suffer, of course we will, but we can change. I remember one time Karuna Shree, a good friend of mine, saying to me down the phone, I was having a moan, she said, you can change every single bit of your life. And that really made a difference to me. You can change every little bit of your life. I think I was feeling a bit trapped about something. And she told me with such conviction that I could change, and such clarity, that there was not one part of my life that I could not change. Now, I think that if we drop down and take on board this working with the law of karma, yeah, I think if we took that on board, I think if I took that on board, I would be ecstatically happy, yeah? A lot of the time, I would be absolutely uncontainable. I think I would be running down Socky Hall Street going, have you heard the good news? Mm-hmm. Actions have consequences. Yeah. Heard it here first. So these four mind-turning reflections, they're just like a drumbeat, yeah? Drumbeat of truth that's sounding behind our existence in these worldly winds, yeah? Or if we take the analogy of the wind, maybe the four mind turnings are like little tinkling chimes hanging in the trees, blowing in the breeze of the worldly winds themselves, yeah? Little chimes reminding us, like the lute song of impermanence. Now, y'all know that Tsongkhapa verse, yeah? And it fits onto these. The human body, at peace with itself, is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish your body, it is yours, this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty, it is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life, you must know as the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal. Make use of every day and night to achieve it. So, if we look more closely here at the faults of conditioned existence, the defects of samsara, if we look more closely here, we come to these eight worldly winds. Yeah. Now, there are lots of ways of looking at samsara. There's the wheel of life. It's a really pretty brilliant way of looking at conditioned existence, and it's a very complex symbol that you won't get to the bottom of. But I think that this teaching or set of reflections yields some very good stuff for us. So, the eight worldly winds, traditionally they're known as the Loka Dhammas, yeah? And there's a sutta about them that you can find in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's called the Loka Vipati Sutta, and Loka Vipati is meaning the failings of the world, yeah? So, it says, the sutta says that there are these eight. There's gain and loss. Interesting translation, status and disgrace, censure and praise, pleasure and pain. And it says that worldly people experience these eight, And wise people, they experience these eight as well. So wise people, what's the difference? Yeah, but what's the difference between worldly people and wise people experiencing the worldly winds? Well, wise people reflect. That's number one difference. They reflect on what is arising. They don't welcome the gain and rebel against the loss. Yeah? Their minds aren't consumed by the winds. And then, because of that, they are released from suffering and stress. And the end of the sutta says, gain and loss, status and disgrace, censure and praise, pleasure and pain. These conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, and subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. His welcoming and rebelling are scattered, gone to their end, do not exist. Knowing the dustless, sorrowless state she discerns rightly, has gone beyond becoming to the further shore. So, a penetrating insight into these transient states is a path to liberation, according to the Buddha. It's big stuff. But why? Why might this work for us? Why? So, obvious thing first off is that all fours challenge, they cut into straight away our sense of security, yeah? And they get to the root of our self-cherishing, yeah? So self-cherishing, I love that phrase, and you hear Tibetan teachers use it quite often. It's not a good thing, just in case there's an actual translation here. Self-cherishing is not good, yeah, yeah? It's not self-metta, it's not self-compassion. Self-cherishing is the cherishing, the holding to the selfhood, yeah? So it's clinging on to an illusory security, yeah? Hiding to nothing, yeah? So these four pairs, they push right to that root of self-cherishing. We're buffeted by them, yeah? Because it's easy to get caught up in them and not see their transience and impermanence. So they buffet us, yeah, the winds. And they buffet how we are and how we want to be. And they challenge our security and our illusion of a safely continuing existence in an assuredly easeful state. Yeah. Or, you know, it's like, basically, I mean, I remember when I had, when I was ill and I had ME, I would do this thing again and again where I would completely over-identify with the state that I was in, yeah? So if I was having a really, really bad day, that was all I was ever going to have, yeah? And if I was having a really good day and I could put my clothes on and go to the charity shop, I was going to have a, you know, that was it. It was all up from there on in. And I think there's something about this narrow over-identification with an intense experience, yeah? Forgetting that it's transient, that it's fleeting. So within these, and within the positives as well as the painful ones, if we have a practice of developing metta and developing the other Brahmaviharas, we can sit loose to this content and let go of self-clinging, yeah? And we will be able to measure our relative discomfort with more perspective. Yeah, we'll be able to see our relative discomfort here with more perspective. I might be able to see that I think it's a shame because I've only got an iPhone 4S, but that is actually better than being homeless and sleeping in a doorway, yeah? So we have a lot of opportunity to realise if we look at where we're grazing our knees on the more difficult worldly winds. Then I think with metta and with the Brahma Viharas, we can just look around a bit more and just gain a bit more perspective. Yeah, even if we just look to our own lives, we just see that the ground is shifting all the time. Yeah, and the winds help us see that samsara is endless and that it will not be fixed. I think if we look at the worldly winds, if we feel the wind in our face enough, then I think we have to surrender and know that there is nothing to be done except to go for refuge to something higher. Yeah. Remember one time I was in Cambridge working in the evolution shop, and Varadakini was running this all-night meditation where we'd spend an hour doing the prostration practice and then we'd spend an hour doing a sitting meditation. And then you'd have like a 30-second break, and then you spend an hour doing the prostration practice and an hour doing a sitting meditation. And we were doing that, and it was on the sitting meditation, and I just became in the grip of fear right in my stomach. And it was pain, it was like colic pain, but it was just fear. My body was clenching, and it was absolutely excruciating. I didn't have the energy to run out the shrine room, so I was just locked into this pain, into this this fear. And then it was time to do the prostration practice, and what a relief it was to just actually, I was just like, it was that moment where you are the rabbit in the headlights and there's nothing to do but go for refuge to the Buddha, because everything else is madness, you know. So, and I'm really grateful for that experience, actually, the clarity of actually, there's nothing to hold on to here. It's like, it was like a small, tiny moment of crisis in which going for refuge was the only way to walk. So, yeah, sometimes there is nothing to be done except to go for refuge to something higher. But even trying to kind of navigate these winds, you know, like if you're in a sailing boat and you're trying to go with the wind and navigate with the wind, even dealing with these pairs on their own terms, yeah, can give rise to some pretty fantastic qualities and some pretty fantastic opportunities. I think the chief of the kind of qualities that reflection on this can give rise to is equanimity. Yeah, equanimity, but I'll say more about that. So the pairs are gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and infamy, and in the sutta that was status and disgrace, which I think is really helpful if fame is a bit hard to relate to. And lastly, pleasure and pain. Now, Vajragupta has written a really good book on the eight worldly winds. I think it's called Sailing the Eight Worldly Winds, or Sailing the Worldly Winds. That's a very good read, and I would recommend that. And he takes a very interesting tack, to use a sailing metaphor. He gives examples using really small everyday stuff. Yeah, he's not going to talk about anybody's house being burnt down. It's all small everyday stuff. And he says, and I think it works, he says it's not big, dramatic, acute examples, because it's in the small and in the commonplace that things about our mind habits can be revealed, yeah? It's almost like in the small, everyday, almost imperceptible, there's an intimacy of where our views are and where we cling and cherish, yeah? So, you know, it's a bit like when it's comfortable, like when you're with your nearest and dearest, you can be like really crabby and really shabby and a bit terrible. because it seems normal and intimate, and I think these small little glitches can show deep patterns, ingrained attitudes and characteristics. Yeah, sometimes big stuff, Vajragupta argues, sometimes big stuff can bring out the best in us, yeah, which is great. You know, it's like we can have like a heroic surge and do something amazing, but that isn't necessarily going to turn around our deeper, more habitual states. And often, practice is in the real work in our practice is in the detail. I believe this anyway. I believe this. And I remember one time giving a talk, and I got all excited about this, about the detail, and I said the moksha is in the detail, you know, the liberation is in the detail, because we say the devil is in the detail, but I think the liberation is in the detail, because it's where our habits reside. And he gives this great example of Vajragupta, give you just a bit of his flavour. In the loss and gain couplet, he says that he used to live on this street that was like a narrow street, and it was all about parking, right? It was all about parking, yeah? And quite often the battleground for our mental states is around driving. But this was all about parking because his next door neighbours had three cars. It's out of order, isn't it? So he'd get close to home and he would just get really, really tense because would there be a space outside his house? Would there be a space outside his house? Would there be? And he would just be like a dog with a bone. And if there was a space outside his house, be like, yes, fantastic. I like to imagine Vajragupta being like the little boy with the football jersey over his head, running. And if there was no space and he had to park down the road and walk up the street, he would be absolutely bailing. And I just think that's a kind of really good example in our lives about how we're equating parking with loss and gain. Really? Really? Anyway, I said I wasn't going to give any big dramatic examples, but I am going to give an example, which is from a few years ago. Now, it was a kind of everyday Wednesday evening when the Wednesday night class team were having their team meeting, and Angela came in a bit late and a bit, oh my God, and she sat down and she said, I went into work today and I've been told, and I've lost my job. And she was a bit white, and she, I don't know if she burst into tears, but anyway, it was a big deal, and she'd lost her job completely unexpectedly there and then. And underlying that, it was like about 2 months or something before we were about to go on pilgrimage, and Angela had signed up to go on the pilgrimage, and she had money to pay for the pilgrimage, and she had her mortgage to pay, and the rug was gone. Whew. But then she was telling this story, and then she said these words. She said, the Buddha told me this was going to happen. And I just thought that was absolutely phenomenal, really. And I thought, that's it. That's how you sail these winds now. The Buddha told me this was going to happen. So there was a real shock, but then there was like perspective. There was an active perspective there. Fantastic. Well, I'll get over it. So yeah, a moment of spiritual death there. So there's a meditation practice called the six element practice, yeah? And the six element practice is kind of like a reflection that says that everything in our bodies is made up of these elements. The food that we take in, the earth element. So our bodies are made up of the earth element and it's maintained by food, you know? But it's like, we're taking in the earth element to maintain us, and we're shedding the earth element all the time. All the time the earth element is leaving our bodies. Hair is dropping off, skin is dropping off, all the cells in our body are renewing. We're taking in and we're letting go the earth element, because what we're made up of isn't belonging to us, yeah? It's just moving through, yeah? Just passing through. It's like you live in your house, right? You live in your house and your address, and you think that's your house. It's really not your house. It's just where you're residing for now. Yeah? Do some deep time. Right now in your mind, just do some deep time. You're not going to be there for much longer. You've hardly been there at all. Blink of an eye. Yeah? So the six element practice is saying that we are taking in the earth element. We think it's making us solid, but we're losing our solidity all the time. Yeah? We're taking on board liquids, and we're losing liquids. Yeah, we're taking on board heat and we're losing heat. We're taking in breath. You holding that breath? Is that your breath? Has it got your name on it? So we're losing it all the time. We're letting it go all the time. And that's the beauty of the six element practice, is it's an opportunity to notice that we're letting go, whether we want to or not, all the time. And all we have to do is just align ourselves to that. Yeah. Because at death, we let go a whole lot more. So we can develop an insight and an appreciation, a beautiful appreciation that that's happening to everyone all the time, yeah? And, you know, that sense of letting go and loss If you're not experiencing it right now, it's in the post. It's got a stamp on it and it's coming. So Vajragupta does this thing in his book where he says, you've got these pairs, gain and loss. And then there's a higher factor that transcends them. And he's got his higher factors, and I'd worked out my higher factors too, and then I'd remembered his, so we compared notes. And we came up with the same one for this, which is generosity, isn't it? It's like, you're gaining stuff, yay! You're losing stuff, boo. Give it away, it was never yours to start with. So generosity is a higher transcending factor in that pair. So praise and blame, brothers and sisters, it's a big one. It's a big one. In terms of the act of blame, so you know this, don't you? Those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. So that's the act of blaming. But similarly, to be on the receiving end of blame, yeah? And I think that's kind of pointing, being in a state of receiving blame or being praised, yeah? As the wind blows at you. Well, I would say it's inevitable. I would say, unfortunately, I'm going to try not to do it to you, but I would say that it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And it's probably going to hurt. Well, it does, doesn't it? It hurts like it grates. It's rubbish. I've got nothing profound to say about it. It's rubbish. When people blame us, this was something that Vajrasara said in a talk about the worldly winds. She said, when people blame us, we can be in a bit of a hurry to insist that that's unjust. Hold on a minute. But if people praise us, are we as assiduous about whether or not it's actually true? Yeah? Is that really what I'm like? You know? You got your reckoner out. I just thought that was genius, yeah? Because it's all about this, isn't it? This is me for the tape, my lad. You know? I'm making myself into something here and I don't want them pulling me down. Yeah, so being seen to be appreciated and right not to blame. God, it's so important to us, yeah? We can be terrified of being perceived as to be in the wrong. Terrified of that. That talk that I gave when I said I was giving a talk at the chairs meeting about the practice of being a centre chair, there were three short talks and I went first and I said about blame. Talked about blame. And then everybody else who gave a talk talked about blame as well, you know, because it's just in our relationships, isn't it? It's in the rub, yeah? Oh, whew. So Vajragupta says a great thing. I mean, look, all I can say about this is feel it. Feel it and let it go. And I mean the praise as well, but laugh at yourself, you know, when you're wagging your tail. But be kind. Put it away. Put it away. So Vajragupta says a good thing about his higher factor in this, the transcender. He says it's truthfulness. Yeah? When I thought, okay, it's like Akshobhya's mirror. You know, is it sticking to me or is it bouncing off? Truth. But I was relating to this more in the kind of self-cherishing way about being puffed up or thinking that you're rubbish. And actually I thought about it in terms of humility. There's a traditional way of talking about humility in the Buddhist tradition. It says that conceit, you'll know this, won't you? Conceit comprises of seeing yourself as better than other people. And conceit also comprises of seeing yourself as worse than other people. It's like you're the best worst. You're the most rubbish. But it also comprises of seeing yourself as the same as others. Because it's me. Me, I, mine. Me, I. It's just that tendency, like that. And that's conceit. It's an over-concern with this, yeah? And a cutting off, yeah? So give it a wee rest. The Buddhist tradition says, give it a wee rest. Okay, so fame and infamy. Status and disgrace. I find this a bit harder to think about. Maybe I thought about the fame end of it a bit too much, you know. I suppose a bit like in the praise and blame thing, there's that concern for having a good reputation, yeah? And something else that Vajrasara says, which is useful, is she says, are there ever times when you don't speak up in case you're disliked, you know, which is a moment of infamy? But I also think in terms of status or disgrace, there's really being over concerned about how you're seen. And some people have got a real concern that they want to be good. Yeah, they want to be good. And seen as good. And probably a bunch of people in this room will relate to the same thing, only the opposite, which is wanting to be seen as a real badass, you know? And that's your fame, you know? Again, it's all about you, isn't it? So yes, wanting to be seen as bad, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, yeah? It's really important sometimes. It's really important to some people how they're seen, yeah? God, I got a bit caught up in watching this 7.5-hour documentary about O.J. Simpson. It was pretty amazing because it gave a background to the civil rights movement, but more importantly, the shocking conduct, racial discrimination of the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department. But there was something really gross about it, which was OJ's being in love with himself, you know, Narcissus in the mirror, in the pond. Oh, anyway, I'll never get those 7.5 hours back. But yeah, it makes me think about pride, you know, the poison that we experience uniquely in the human realm. Yeah, the poison in Ratnasambhava's realm. Ratnasambhava helps us here transmute this poison. And what does he change it to? It's miraculous. He changes it into the Samatha Jnana, yeah? The wisdom of sameness, yeah? The wisdom of sameness. It's just like we're born, we die, we suffer, we love, yeah? We're all, at one time or another, that person sleeping in a wet sleeping bag in Sockey Hill Street. That's the Samatha Jnana, yeah? So there's a higher factor in Vajragupta's reckoning, which is individuality. Isn't he a clever man? Individuality, he's saying, in terms of fame and infamy. But actually, and I agree with that, but I just thought at this point it's time to mention equanimity. Because for me that's just such an important balancing factor. And it's the culmination of the Brahmaviharas. I mean, how can we sail these worldly winds without the Brahmaviharas? So equanimity, the capacity to hold strong experience, yeah? Sort of one's heart is metaphor enough to be steady. And sometimes it's a practice, and Shantideva will say, well, you know, if there's bad stuff going on, say to yourself, I will remain like a block of wood. It's good advice sometimes. Yes. It's like equanimity, it's like an emotional freedom, yeah? So pleasure and pain, yeah. Now, when I was thinking about pleasure and pain, I was thinking about them more as a kind of subjective experience, a kind of inner experience. And I was thinking about these as a bit more outer. I don't know if that's bogus, but anyway, that's what I was thinking about. I was thinking about emotional pain, that's what I was thinking about, rather than, you know, breaking your leg pain and having to overcome something when it's difficult, because whether we experience overcoming a difficulty as real pain or not, it's kind of up to us. So something that the mindfulness movement has really talked about well is the second arrow syndrome. Yeah, the second arrow syndrome. I'm confident that you'll all be acquainted with that. So there's a sutta, the Sala Sutta, yeah, the Sutta of the Dart, that says, if by lamenting, confused, harming yourself, any use could be gained, the prudent would do it as well. But not by weeping and grief do you gain peace of awareness. Pain arises all the more. Yeah. So the second arrow syndrome, something happens to us that's painful, the arrow goes in. Ugh. But rather than just being with that experience, it's as if we're pierced a second and more deadly time, because we kind of go, I can't believe this happened to me. And the outrage, or whatever it is, or the identification with the pain, yeah? So, but there isn't that. There's weeping and grief, yeah? And so pain arises all the more. So something bad happens to us, yeah? And we can't just breathe into it, yeah? We overinvest in it, yeah? And so we're pierced a second time. And the sutta finishes, seeking your own happiness, you should pull out your own arrow, your own lamentation, longing and sorrow. With arrow pulled out, independent, attaining peace of awareness, all grief transcends. Griefless, you are unbound. How do you do that? You do that through being aware. Being patiently aware. Yeah. Not freaking out and just realizing that all beings suffer. All beings suffer. Don't freak out. Just breathe into it and let it pass. Let it pass. Yeah? So this pleasure and pain couplet, it's right in there, isn't it? It's right in there in the wheel of life, the hub of the wheel of life. We've got, you know, our ignorance is made up of so much clinging and so much aversion, all meshed up together. The mechanics of that. That's the mechanics of the unenlightened mind. Grasping on hard, trying to grasp on hard to a pleasant sensation, yeah? Or a pleasant idea, which is like a sensation, and pushing away pain, yeah? So we're losing a grip here on the truth that dukkha is unavoidable, yeah? And so we lose out on staying soft to the arising of awareness that will help that suffering pass, probably pass much quicker, if we don't try and push the second arrow in, yeah? So Vajragupta is saying that because of this pleasure and pain, because we grasp onto, fix onto, or push away, he says the higher factor for transcending them is mindfulness. I can't disagree with him. But I just kind of was thinking, well, somewhere, if you've, yeah, with mindfulness, I'm not disagreeing with him, but with mindfulness, I think if you bring metta to that, wisdom arises. You know? You can't really be in this business without love. Yeah? Love for the way it is. It's a bit shit. Wisdom can arise from there. Again, equanimity in a way. So the Buddha really experienced the worldly winds during the attack of Mara. Yeah. So Mara blew like a hurricane. Who do you think you are, son? You're nothing. Arrows of pain and enticing forms to offer pleasure. But the Buddha just sat there with equanimity, yeah? Because he was in touch with the precious opportunity he had in that very life, yeah? That very birth, that very life. He was in touch with the defects of samsara, so he couldn't be beguiled. So he sat and the arrows just turned into flowers. And the earth broke open and the goddess was summoned and she came forth from the earth. And she testified that he had been holding steady with that equanimity. He'd been holding steady to a skillful path for many lifetimes. and then the rest is history. Yeah. So I think that's all I've got to say about the eight worldly winds. It's like in an old movie where the kind of pages blow over. Yeah. Okay. So when I started writing this talk, I thought I was writing a talk about the eight worldly winds and the four right efforts, but then I kind of fell into the four mind turnings. So the four right efforts get a little fly past at this point. The four right efforts, here they are. This is a bit in the, sorry, that's not very dignified. This is a part of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is one of the limbs. And it's working against the grasping onto and the shoving away tendencies that I mentioned earlier. So this takes me straight back into that business about, isn't the law of karma really fantastic? Isn't it our only hope? Yeah, because right here we are working with fresh karma. Fresh karma is meeting previously established vipaka. Yeah, so you've kind of got a state that you're in, whether it's skillful or unskillful. And the right effort is to respond appropriately, yeah, to that vipaka, to that what's arisen, with a fresh action. And we develop skillful responses by having an awareness and using this law of karma. So the first two efforts, what are they, Dasani? The first of the four right efforts is to prevent unarisen, unskillful states. So it hasn't cropped up yet, but it's in danger of cropping up, and it's not going to be very good, right? So it's responding appropriately. And then the next one is eradicating, getting rid of, moving along the way, something unskillful that's already arisen, yeah? And then you are developing, you're bringing into being, welcoming in, not yet arisen, skillful states. And lastly, you're maintaining skillful states that have come into being. Yeah. So the first two, the preventing unskillful stuff or eradicating unskillful stuff, that's really what we call guarding the gates of the senses, isn't it? Yeah. Being heedful, using apramada, like the Buddha told us to just before he died. He said, Dasani, everything is impermanent. Yeah, with heedfulness, on you go. Yeah, tread the path. So apramada, taking care, being mindful, taking heed of the effect, yeah, of our karma. Yeah. So here it's being heedful of the effect of negative influences. And the preventing bit, it involves keeping up, being particularly aware of and keeping up skillful patterns, habits, practices that we've got. So we're not taking risks, yeah, with the ground that we've gained, yeah. And the first two, the preventing stuff and eradicating stuff, is using the abstaining bit of the precepts, yeah. And of course this bit, developing and maintaining, is using the positive precepts. It's just spelling that out for us, helping us reflect on this. Yep. Now, I have to get into an image with this. I don't know if this is an image, but I was thinking about the preventing and eradicating as resisting the pull of the conditioned. The pull of the conditioned, yeah? So Sangha Action, when he's talking about stream entry, yeah? He uses these great metaphors of the pool of the conditioned and the pool of the unconditioned, like forces, yeah, like forces. Like that's a planet and that's a planet, and where are you going to get to and what force are you going to go with? So the conditioned and the unconditioned. So the pool of the conditioned is just like, it's like going with your bad habits, basically, for want of a, that's a not very erudite description of the pool of the conditioned. It's just like falling into stuff. And the pull of the unconditioned, well, the unconditioned is that which is not conditioned by greed, hatred, and delusion, yeah? So it's basically more liberated, more enlightened qualities, yeah? So Why am I talking about this? Because this is being aware of the pool of the conditioned, and this is being aware of the pool of the unconditioned. So we are weighting our habits towards whatever is free from greed, hatred, and delusion. We're developing and maintaining whatever is free of those traces of greed, hatred, and delusion. I'm not claiming that by practicing the four right efforts, we will all move from self-power to other power, right? That's kind of up to you, and I can't comment on that. But I think that developing and maintaining efforts that are in harmony with, are basically workings out of the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path, is what this is about, yeah? So developing vision, developing positive emotion, skillful speech, skillful action, right livelihood, these efforts, mindfulness and dhyana, yeah? That is what this teaching is trying to encourage us to develop and maintain, yeah? It's encouraging us to develop and maintain the six perfections, yeah? Generosity, ethics, patience, energy, dhyana, and wisdom. Now, the figure of Avalokiteshvara is a figure of tremendous energy. Yeah? All that power expressed in that symbol, those 11 heads, all those arms, they are really using all that power, that concentrated energy, for developing and maintaining, to keep alive a fresh and compassionate response to all beings. Yeah? Huge energy in that symbol. Yeah? And these positive efforts, they've just become completely naturalized. Yeah? They've become, in a beautiful way, second nature to the Bodhisattva. Yeah? So the energy to pick up the crystal rosary. Yeah? The energy of holding softly the lotus, holding the wish-granting gem. Yeah? To pick up and offer confidence, clarity, patience, whatever it is, steadiness, meditation, unfailing compassion. So at a certain point, this energy and effort in this Bodhisattva has become spontaneous. It's become an effortless effort, yeah? It's become an effortless effort because it's wholehearted, yeah? It's wholly sensitive to what causes pain, yeah? And therefore, it's wholly attracted to what leads to good. So for us now, the bottom line, after I've talked for a long time, is that time is short and that we have to choose and we have to keep choosing. Yeah? So I think we have to keep going back to the mind turning reflections. Keep turning our mind to practicing for the sake of ourselves and for the sake of others. Now, when I went through these mind turnings and I read that very well-known Tsongkhapa verse, yeah, the verse talks about the ephemeral nature of our lives. The verse that we're used to talks about the ephemeral nature of our lives as being like a raindrop, yeah? But I've got a different translation, and it says the ephemeral nature of our lives is like chaff. Bit different. Chaff is the husks from corn or another seed crop, yeah? The husk that protects the seeds, and it's cut away, or it could be blown away, that's why it's ephemeral. It could be blown away, it's cut out and it's mixed in to straw for like a feed crop. It's not very, our ego isn't going to want to go, I'm like chaff. Like a Timothy advert, you know. On a good day, when you're in a positive state, you might be okay with being likened to a raindrop. Yeah, thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. This translation doesn't say that. It says you're like chaff. It's a bit different. But I kind of like that. It's not a lovely image. But I think it pulls out the defects. I think it pulls out the defects of samsara in a bit more of a gritty way. So I'm going to finish with this verse. It's short and I'll read it twice. This is... Oh, lovely Robert Thurman. Yeah. So this translation, he says it's done by a bunch of different scholars, so they're not attributed here. This working basis of a human form endowed with liberties is superior to a wish-granting gem. Moreover, such is only obtained this very one time, difficult to acquire and easily lost. It passes in a flash like lightning in the sky. Considering how easily this can happen at any time, and realizing that all worldly activities are as immaterial as chaff, you must try to take advantage of its essential significance at all times, day and night. I, the yogi, have practiced in the same way. I'll read it one more time. The working basis of a human form endowed with liberties is superior to a wish-granting gem. Moreover, such is only obtained this very one time. Difficult to acquire and easily lost, it passes in a flash like lightning in the sky. Considering how easily this can happen at any time, and realizing that all worldly activities are as immaterial as chaff, you must try to take advantage of its essential significance at all times, day and night. I, the yogi, have practiced in the same way.